Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic, as always, by Maricela Garza and Cheryl Lindemann, and we have a guest that Mari is going to introduce as well.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Friday, right?
Yes.
I want to welcome Alicia Miranda. She's a public services librarian working at the South Lansing, the downtown Lansing, and our foster branch. She's been a librarian with us for a year-ish plus, maybe. She's a native Californian, and she was here actually as a library assistant before she became a librarian with us. So welcome, Alicia.
Thank you for having me.
So yeah. It's starting to feel fall. It's not quite fall when we're taping this, but it's certainly starting to feel that way. We've got a lot going on for the system, and we've all got really neat books to share.
Yeah.
Want to just jump in?
Yeah, that sounds good. The books that I have today, I'm going to separate them out, but they are definitely in line with some sort of special interest areas that I've always had with books. And one of them is, even though I do not like horror or true crime, I love disaster stories. So when I was a child, I loved like these like plane crash movies. And so I was really pretty young, too young for these. I liked the one about Jim Jones that was true crime, you know, the Kool-Aid. You know, I watched that as like a little kid. It was, you know, Gen X parents were just a little bit looser, third child. They're just like, she's fine, just eating cookies, watching these things. So I kind of have this interest still in that, especially ships, like shipwrecks, Antarctica, you know, that sort of thing, Shackleton, that always interests me. So sometimes when we're reading reviews for the two of you, probably, you know, maybe notice this too, you just have a feeling a book is going to be big. Mm-hmm. And when I read the review for this book, it's called A Marriage at Sea, A True Story of Love, Obsession, and Shipwreck by Sophie Elmhurst. And it was just on Obama's summer reading list as well. I knew this was going to be a big book. And part of it is the cover. It's really gorgeous, and it really kind of draws you in. There's something about it. I just could tell it was going to be a big book. And we put it on our summer reading list for the LSJ, and it has been a really big book so far. So I'm sorry, there is still a pretty big hold list on it. We do have lots of copies in the system, but I'm going to be pretty brief about explaining it because the magic of the story is in reading it. I don't want to give anything away. So this is the story, a true story of Marilyn and Maurice Bailey. It's in the 1970s. They're living in England. They're living a life that they're just not really into. They have their jobs. They end up saving for a home. They're bored. They have this, both of them have this really restless, wandering spirit. And they decide, let's sell absolutely everything and get a boat, get a little ship. And let's sail to New Zealand. And when we get there, we'll get jobs there and totally reinvent our lives. Maurice in particular has had a very terrible childhood. He has a lot of sort of mental baggage from this. And they both just don't feel this big tie to England. They want to go. So they work really hard. They sell everything. They work on this little ship called the Aura Lynn, which is sort of a combination of their names. And they go out on sea. And they have lots of food. They've done pretty good research, but they decide not to have any like electronic tracking type device installed at all. It's part of the adventure. They don't want it. They just want to go do this. So they go off. Things are going well. They meet some people. You know, they go into different ports and they go back out. But they get into the Pacific. They're quite far. They're not close to any land at this point. And a sperm whale smashes into their ship. And so hard that it starts to sink. So they grab absolutely everything they can, and they get into their little dinghy and this little tiny raft. And you can find the pictures of the raft online. And they get into the raft, and they have to survive this way. They watch all their whole investment sink. Their ship just sinks. And so they're in this little tiny raft, and they're trying to survive. I don't even want to tell you how long this all goes, because I don't want to give anything else away except for that it's extremely harrowing. They end up near death. They have to eat the creatures that they, because all their food goes away. There's illness. There's botched rescue attempts where their flares get wet and they can't send them out. There's a lot that goes on here, but not only is it the story of harrowing survival and of great natural beauty as well, being on the sea, but it's also the story of their marriage and their relationship and how Marilyn really is the rock for Maurice in this extreme way. And it's kind of beautiful in a way to see just how much he relies on her, and that really, that's a big piece of the story as well. So, A Marriage at Sea, I encourage you to read it. It's a great adventure and just beautifully written. It's written, it's sort of offensive to nonfiction to always say things are written like fiction, so I don't want to really use that expression, but it's written in this really readable way, and you just are sucked through the story. You can't put it down. You really want to know what happens.
Accessible.
Yes, and very beautiful. Accessible. Yeah.
That's sort of where we're going instead exactly. of that.
Yeah, it's beautifully written and you're not bogged down. Mm-hmm. It's a dazzling book, says Patrick Redden. All right.
Alicia? I guess in terms of, I love the ocean. We'll always love the ocean. From Southern California. I think that was one of the toughest parts of living in Lansing, Michigan was, I mean, you guys have the Great Lakes, and I do make a point to visit it as often.
As far as you can possibly.
Exactly. Right. And I have told friends that I'd never lived somewhere landlocked, so Michigan was a good enough option. I do sometimes get people who are like, the lakes are just like the oceans. I'm like, the lakes are really beautiful, you're right. But the ocean has always been something that, like, I love a big body of water. And the book that I really want to talk about is called Kai of the Ocean. It is about this Chinese American girl who lives in Hawaii, I should say. And she experiences some really significant anxiety. And I grew up in the era where young adult fiction very much was not written for me and was not written towards the Asian American experience. And I definitely grew up in an era where, like, mental health was still not very much talked about, especially in Asian American spaces. So I was really intrigued. I'm, like, really intrigued about this new generation of authors who are Asian American, who really speak to the cultural realities of mental health and cultural realities of, like, just being a kid. and like being allowed to be a kid without, I guess there's still some family pressures, but in a real way that didn't feel like, ooh, look at this new thing that I have no idea how to write. So I was really drawn to this book, and I thought one part that I was really intrigued by was that Kaya has ocean powers because she is this descendant of this Chinese water goddess, Mazu. And her anxiety influences kind of how she controls the ocean. And I thought this book was very unique because it displays her powers not as like a central piece of the story, but kind of a visual metaphor for her anxiety. And I thought that level of magical realism in juvenile fiction was really refreshing because it's really hard to explain to adults what anxiety feels like, especially Asian American parents. No, just Asian parents, I should say. And I think this was a really good book for me to read because it gives me an idea of kind of the language that's being used right now for now generation of Asian American kids that struggle with anxiety and the kind of ways that they approach it, how it looks like with their friends, because that looked a lot different when I was a kid. So this story really revolves around her both trying to manage her friendships and her anxiety, her relationships with her parents and her anxiety, and also just herself and the way that she eventually kind of seeks help in that. So,
Well, thank you. Sounds excellent.
Yeah.
There's a lot of whimsy, and it was really, like, I thought it was really fun. But despite all the heavier topics of anxiety, it was also like, man, I really wish that I was on a beach at this very moment.
Absolutely.
Well, I've got the next book. This is Mari, and it's a young adult titled Tall Water. It's a graphic novel. It's by S.J. Sindhu, illustrated by Diane MBD. And this was a really neat graphic novel because in some ways there were sort of some dream sequences, but for the most part, it's, you know, a story of a teen. It starts out with, you know, Nimi is her name. She is living with her father in South Dakota. She's not quite sure how long ago, but she's recently moved to South Dakota from Massachusetts and feels very somewhat isolated, maybe. She doesn't say this in the book, but you can just tell that she feels like an outsider. She is, you know, doing her interview to get into Columbia, and she has a very strong conversation with the person who's interviewing her. She wants to be a journalist, and I was really struck by like some of the things that she said about, you know, she just feels very strongly that objectivity is pretty much impossible as a journalist. And I was like, wow, because I grew up, I remember taking journalism classes. I was like, I don't think I thought that when I was going through school. So anyway, she is either half or partial, I'm not quite sure, a Sri Lankan teen. She moved from Sri Lanka as a baby. Her father took her during a wartime in Sri Lanka. And she's not seen her mother in like all of her life. She left when she was one, and she's had communication with her. And she's always wanted to go back to Sri Lanka to meet her mother, who is working very passionately in an orphanage. So her father, who's a reporter, her father and her mother, both reporters, have really inspired her trek in life. She wants to be a journalist as well, but she somehow sneaks over to Sri Lanka when her father goes over there. And it's this story of her coming to grips with just like what war is like, and like being around military that, I mean, we have some little snippets lately, but I feel like in general, you don't have the US military coming at you with guns and things like that. But she's coming across all these things. And it's just this really neat story of her learning her culture, and in some ways having a reconciliation with her mother, because she's been really hurt all this time. I mean, she's not seen her mother in the 16 years that she's been away. She has had communication with her, but there's just a really, it was just a story that for me was like, wow, I don't think very many teens come across this sort of situation, but maybe I'm wrong. I just, you know, she's had a life where she was not a refugee, but there's just a lot of issues of, you know, separation and isolation and wondering who you really are. This is a great story. There was also a small reference to the big tsunami that happened in 2004 in that part of the world. So, yeah, I really liked this graphic novel because she gave me an insight into teens going through family, parental, really, forms of reconciliation. So,
okay. Yeah. I guess I'm going to take us from a lot of water-based work to more green. I want to talk about nature and the mind, the science of how nature improves cognitive, physical, and social well-being. It sounds very clinical. It is not. It is a book by Mark G. Berman. He is Michigan-born and raised, actually, like Grand Rapids, Upper families. He is, one set of his grandparents were Holocaust survivors. The other side fought in the war. Other grandfather fought in the war. He has this history behind him of, you know, knowing that people can do horrible things to each other. And he also has a strong interest in, he had an interest in technology. He actually went to U of M, was planning to study kind of engineering, ends up taking a psychology class, and it sort of changes his life. He gets into working kind of in starts working in labs on the kind of technical end of it, but his mentors sort of realize he's really more, he really needs to be working more on the psychology side of it. But he kind of coins the study, the name of the study of environmental neuroscience. And again, sounds very technical, but it's really interesting. He doesn't fully insert himself into the book, but he's very is a very interesting approach to talking about how we really need our green and blue spaces. We are just our he talks about it in terms of our attention, of direct and indirect attention. Our direct attention is limited. We can only do it for so long. We need a refresh. And kind of starting from a really basic but really interesting study that they did at U of M, they basically had a group of people come in, take a bit of a quiz, and then told them, half of them to go on a walk in Nichols Arboretum and half of them to go on a walk through downtown Ann Arbor, and then had them come back and take the test again. And the people who went through the green space scored significantly better. They then the next week switched them just to, as another test. And again, the people who went through the green space did significantly better. And as you go through the book, he is a bit of an advocate for citizen science in the he gives you things to think about in your own life, things to test in your own life, just to sort of see, does this make you feel better? Does this make you feel more focused? But it's little things. It's things like we are more apt. We react better to fractals, curves, certain colors are all helpful. So the little step of having a plant on your desk is actually a better thing for you. The straight lines of cubicles are not. You know, but it's just, so it is a very interesting, and you know, there's lots of studies that have been done, but this is, it just sort of really walks you through. And it also goes as far as to say, it literally doesn't matter whether you like nature or not. It still helps you reset if you go out on a walk. So it's just, it's an added thing. I've done, you know, I've been an advocate for the birding books. I've talked about Wild Girls by Tam Miles, Soil by the story of Soil by Camille Dungy. It's just me kind of continuing to do some nature reading and really remind myself that I need to get outside and go outdoors. And while I'm on that sort of a topic, I want to remind everybody, and I think this is going to get posted before we actually have the author visit for the One Grand Read, and just remind you that we will have Christian Cooper at Kellogg Center on September 20th, and I'm hoping to see lots and lots of people there, because I think it's going to be really, really interesting. Yeah.
He's a great guy. He's just fantastic.
We
did a really short interview with him, and he is just the sweetest man on earth. No. I'm like in love with him.
I'm not surprised.
Yep, I am not remotely surprised, yeah. And I don't know. It's just, yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hoping to see lots and lots of people there. And then I want to see everybody out wandering around at places like Tollgate and Bancroft and Fenner and every other place we can go and sort of wander and be out in the green and see birds and all that.
Yeah, it's a great time outside right
it
now.
It is a yes. really great time
I
outside
have
right
really
now.
Worked
even
on
just sitting on your porch and listening.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Looking. Wherever
and
you
again,
are.
Again, all of these things are good.
Yeah. I've really worked on a pollinator garden, and I feel like the bees, this is fine. This is my best year for bees. A lot of people are afraid of bees or allergic to bees. I respect that. But the bees, they don't even look at me. They're mm-hmm. swarming on these plants.
Which
and
is
it
great.
Just it makes me happy. And Jessica and I talked a little bit about this. You know, you were saying you kind of go out and look
yes.
look in the morning. And I always go look at the garden when I come home in the morning, every single morning. And it's just like a touchstone in a way.
I think Rissa can attest from where we are. Yep. It's you kind of want to stop and look.
I spend so much time on my balcony. Every time I'm working from home, I am on that balcony.
Yeah.
I do everything on that balcony. I love it because I just get trees. I get groundhogs. We had 2 bucks the other day.
Yep.
Yeah. We get cats. We get everything.
It was pouring, pouring Wednesday night.
It was beautiful.
And I came home in it. So I didn't enjoy being in it, but I was walking from our parking area to my front door, and I stopped because just a doe, I think a doe and a fawn were just sort of staring at me out of the next street over.
It just makes you like feel alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely. So the other thing I want to say is everybody slow down and look around and see what's out there.
That's great. I will say one thing that I have, do say a lot ever since moving to Lansing. I complain a lot about other things, but I mean, but I'm from Southern California and I am a self-proclaimed pretentious person with certain things. But I mean, Lansing has its quirks. But one thing that I noticed and really appreciated was that you guys just have like the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen.
Oh, like,
so like when especially in the fall time, I just like when I leave for the day. I do take a second to like look at the sky, mm-hmm. just like admire how many colors there are. Uh-huh. It's not just like never just like orange. There's
a
burnt orange, and then it like fades into this like really soft pink, into like this like beautiful kind of dusky magenta. And I'm like, this is amazing. And then like the clouds are just coming over at the Capitol, and I'm like, wow, what a world. Uh-huh. Or I just like take time, just I don't know, when I'm walking home or just on a walk, it's like a nice color to be in, mm-hmm. as and like you just feel like I just spend so much time indoors, and especially in the summer I spend so much time outdoors because I know that those are finite moments.
Yes, they are.
In Michigan, I've really appreciated like kind of being mad having to be inside when it's nice outside, because I'm like, there's only a certain amount of days.
Right. It's panicky.
These are getting stolen from me.
Yes.
But there is like, I really appreciate, like, especially during COVID, this is kind of a long winding thing, but especially during COVID, I just sat on the stoop of my house, absorbing the sun. Yeah. And just, I would stay there for hours and hours and hours. And I don't have a stoop right now that has that kind of sunlight, but just being outside is just, what a nice refresh, reset.
Michigan, it's definitely. Yeah.
Yes, I had to learn that the hard way. The cold and I don't super agree.
It's getting warmer.
Yeah. I guess I got that to look forward to.
I mean, sad but true.
The sunsets are pretty though, so I'll take it.
Yes, definitely.
And I think you have the next.
Oh, yes. I am going to talk about Bye For Now. It's by Malia Siddiqui. It has been described as a parent trap-esque novel. And I was already intrigued because I love The Parent Trap. Well, the Lindsay Lohan one. just want to make that clear. I have had friends who are like, have you seen the original? I was like, why would I need to see the original? But anyway, I love the Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap. So I was really interested, and this is, I was also really interested because it was a diverse book about a culture I'm not really familiar with. These are Muslim twins who were separated at birth, and then they happen to, one of them moves into the town of the other one, and they accidentally find out that they're long-lost twins when they start their first day of school, and everyone keeps mistaking them for the other one, and then they finally come face-to-face, and it's just this really jarring moment of, why do you have my face? So I was, like, really intrigued by the hijinks, and I actually was checking it in, and sometimes when I check books in, I like to read just a little bit of a teaser of like, oh, what's this book about? And I couldn't put it down, and then I was like, I should just check it out. I'm at work. but it has, and I think one of the things I really appreciate about this book that the Lindsay Lohan movie doesn't really address, despite its perfection, is like the parent implications of like, it's not cool that your parents separated your siblings. Like, that's not cool.
No, yeah.
And I feel like this book does such a good job of really digging into that layer of like you grew up thinking that your family is one way, and then you suddenly are faced with, my parent has done me wrong in a lot of ways. And I think it's such a complex emotion for a 13-year-old to face, as well as like all the other things going on. Like Ashar, he wants to get into this really fancy hockey academy. He has a single mom, but he also like has the support of his uncle, and he has like one of his best friends is his cousin. So he's like he's like so hard-headed and just ambitious, and he's dealing with all this stuff. And then his twin brother is so the opposite. Like, his dad is this surgeon who travels around a lot. He just never had a stable home life. One of his comfort shows is the home, is like the Property Brothers. Like, that's something that he like loves to watch. And I thought that's such a quirky little detail, but it really makes sense for his character because all he wants is a stable home. So I thought this book does such a good job of a retelling, which is you take something that has been done, but also add this layer of emotional depth that I think like is so valuable for kids to have because it like not only deals with all the parent stuff, but how do you deal with having a brother? And like, that's so different from you. And it's just fun because then you see a little bit of like their personalities really shine through. And it's a really fun book that I also was like really moved by because as an adult, it is really hard to have just very different life transitions. And then seeing that through the eyes of these boys who have a lot going on, but also learn a lot about themselves through learn a lot about themselves, but also learn how to be brothers. And I thought that was a really fun twist to the parent trap trope, I guess, is a good way of saying that. Yeah.
Cool. That's really interesting. Like I think about like, you know, foster care families, they often have to separate siblings because they can't find families to take all the children. And I was just thinking about like nieces and nephews in my family. Like, what would that have been like for them to have not grown up together? And just, I don't know. Yeah. So cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think I'm next, and I've got kind of a few books to promote. I won't say a whole lot about all of them. They're actually early chapter books, and by that I mean, you know, we've got picture books, we've got early readers. I'm thinking of books that maybe a really good first grade reader, second grade reader, third grade reader would want to read after they're done with, you know, the little skinny books that are early readers with the little numbers up in the side. I don't know if you're familiar with those. And these are like very short little stories, often under 100 pages, but they're not at all like to the level of like a middle grade, fifth or sixth, seventh grade level. So coming in at 87 pages is the Willow Woods series by Suzanne Selfers. It's a fairly new series. There's Sam Squirrel, and there's also Rosie Stink Badger. We were talking about nature earlier and just the natural life that's out there. And this is definitely a story that has all these animals out there. Squirrels, elk, chipmunks, you know, and they have this great relationship with Mother Nature. So you'll have to read the series to figure out who exactly is Mother Nature. Really reminded me a lot of Frog and Toad in some ways, a little meatier in terms of words, but really a nice series that I want to recommend. The next one, many parents out there are probably familiar with the Scholastic Branches series. In the corner there, they've got this little tree with branches there. And this is book number one in the Sports Zone version of Branches. Hut, Hut, Hike. It's by Andrew Marinus. This is a great series. Again, under 100 pages. This one's 90. The whole Branch series is directed at those new independent readers and really encourages them to get through the whole book. There's just enough detail and excitement in there. The next one is Miles Lewis Pet Sitter, and this is by Kelly Starling Lyons. She's amazingly also done the Jada Jones chapter book series. Miles is really intrigued by having a pet. His parents don't really think he's quite ready. But this is the Pet Sitter series. Another one that I have not gotten through the whole thing, but again, it's under, this one's like, I think, 50 pages. It's a Marvel After School Heroes. Shuri Takes Control. Really a very nice book to get through as a kid. And then the last one I'm going to mention is Arco's Little House by Jess Fogel. This is sort of like a picture book, but not exactly. It could also be like a graphic novel, a very skinny little book. But again, like this one's 30 pages. They're just really nice books to get your new reader on board with finishing longer books. Yeah. So I I'm really excited that we have this collection. And sometimes they might seem hidden, but ask your librarian in your branch to help you find these books. We do have a list of J chapter books that are under 100-ish pages that would be considered those early chapter books. So we'll post that in the show notes.
Yep, we'll get that there.
And happy going back to school, children.
Yes, absolutely. I remember needing those books when my daughter, who's now 13 and a half, was, I don't know, I don't remember what grade it was, really, first, second, like you said, and it was like Owl Diaries,
yes.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a brand that's nice.
It's always so great to see an explosion in a needed area of publishing.
Yes.
They hit all the easy readers, and they want that sense of accomplishment of reading a true chapter book, but it's just a little too much. And then you don't want to discourage the new reader. I mean, some kids can jump in, but that's a big leap.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went from, like, not really, ironically, I really didn't like to read at all, and then my parents were kind of getting fed up with me because I just wanted to watch TV because I was a child. I just wanted to watch TV, and they like kept incentivizing me to read, and I was like, this is boring, whatever. And my uncle's brother had recommended this fantasy series to me, and they were like chunky, like they were, you know, like huge. And I was like, oh, whatever. And my mom was like, just finish. Like, she tried to get me to read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but, like, anytime your parent forces you to do anything, it's, like, the lamest thing ever.
Yeah.
So I was like, I hate this. So anyway, I was, like, maybe 12 or so. And then, yeah, my uncle's brother had recommended me, like, just try these out. I was like, okay, whatever. So I immediately devoured this series. Like, so I went from almost not reading to these giant chapter books, and I feel like I would have preferred, like, oh, these are really short. I think I was just only reading Geronimo Stilton. So it was like Geronimo Stilton to basically young adult fiction. And like that middle part got lost. So I just, I feel like I just missed an entire genre of books because of just the lack when I was a kid.
So. There just weren't that many.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, they don't get a lot of attention. And that's why I decided to bring them up.
Yeah.
It's just like there really are out there. And They're perfect for that second grader who's kind of beyond.
They cover a lot of topics.
Which
really
is great. On the topic of books that are not published enough and changing publishing, I have my next book. This is one of my top books of the year so far. It's Tony at Random, The Iconic Writer's Legendary Editorship by Dana A. Williams. And during the time of her editorship, in those years, she actually published four of her major works in that time. That's not what this is about. This is actually about her as an editor and not as a writer. And this is quite an amazing book. It goes pretty deep into each publishing.
Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison, yes. What did I say? Oh, I did not. Okay, Tony Rand. Okay, yes, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just want to clarify for people.
Oh, Toni Morrison, yes. And the books that, anyway, so yeah, so this is about her, Toni Morrison, as the editor. And it goes in depth into each editor experience that, not every single one that she did, but many of the relationships that she had with different authors to publish their works. And it was a 16-year job in that position. She went from being an editor of textbooks in a division related to part of Random House to this job where she was the main and only Black editor of books. And she had a mission to publish books about books by Black authors about Black lives, about Black experience, and focusing on lived experience and stories, poetry. And some of the authors that she published are Toni Cade Bambara, Gail Jones. And for some reason, I found the piece about Gail Jones the most interesting in the book. I'm interested in Gail Jones's work quite a bit. And that was a relationship that was actually very fraught. And the story of that one gets really kind of harrowing through the letters. Gail Jones had a very overbearing partner. And if you read about her and if you already know about her, that ended really badly. And that person really interfered. And that comes through in the letters. You get to read a lot of the actual correspondence. Lucille Clifton, which I know I've talked about on the podcast quite a bit. June Jordan. She also published many other people, but a few are Angela Davis, and there's a lot of interesting information about how that happened. And then the book, a book of Muhammad Ali, a biography, autobiography, that took forever to get published for many reasons, and that whole process is painstakingly shown through this book. But what comes through is her incredible integrity, her firmness, her boldness, her strength, and also her great care for the authors, and really wanting sort of nurture some of them if they were more unfamiliar with this process, and sort of she was a mentor to people. She was she challenged them. She did a lot of editing, you know, like some there's different types of editing, but she was really an involved editor. There's things about the covers of the books, the art, how it's going to be promoted, because that was a really big deal. She was very concerned about the publishing industry. She was very concerned about the lack of black editors in the publishing industry, of course, black bookstores. And this is the 1970s, so this period was 1967 to 83. So she was going into this frustrated that she was being as kind of a, seen as like a token, the token black person, the token black editor. But she was very determined to conduct herself with the great integrity that Toni Morrison is really known for, and the strength. I mean, the strength really comes through, and she tussles with some of these authors. It's not hagiography, really. The author, Dana A. Williams, I did want to mention, is the dean of the graduate school at Howard University, and she's a professor of African American literature. She delved deep into the archives to pull this book together. It is an incredible work of, you know, in a way of scholarship. So I wanted to leave. There were so many Toni Morrison quotes that I wanted to use, but I think this one was really good. This was at 1976, a conference on Afro-American writers. And it's the second conference that had happened. And she said, "I think that the survival of black publishing, which to me is a sort of way of saying the survival of black writing, will depend on the same things that the survival of black anything depends on," she stated, "which is the energies of black people, sheer energy, inventiveness and innovation, tenacity, the ability to hang on in a contempt for those huge monolithic institutions and agencies which do obstruct us. In other words, we must do our work." And I think that as editor, she really did.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's really awesome. I think a lot about the ways that publishing has changed so drastically. Yeah. It's such like, it feels like such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And so I guess to tie that into the book I want to talk about, which Mari had talked about previously on the podcast, was Everything We Never Had by Randy Ribay. He is a Filipino-American author. And again, I mentioned this already, but I didn't grow up with any representation at all. Like, I'm Filipino, but even just generally the Asian American experience. So finding an author that was so specific to my culture and experience was really impactful. I didn't read, so my first book of Randy Ribay's was Patron Saints of Nothing, which blew my mind. But then I picked this book up just this year. It was published last year. I didn't realize like how much more he could just get into the DNA of just my culture. And I think, so this book is about basically this boy and his father's history, his grandfather's history, and his great-grandfather's history. It's this intergenerational look of kind of his family and what that experience looks like as his grandfather lives with them during COVID. It was really interesting to see a lot of my life experience through the eyes of this fictional character, and even like things that his father or his grandfather had said, I had almost predicted in my head what they were going to say, because that's like something I heard my dad says, or my mom says, or aunts, uncles. So it's interesting to see the publishing industry, like it's not perfect, it's far from perfect, right. But to even have this amount of visibility of like someone who isn't Filipino American can like see and maybe understand, or even the mention of the inclusion of the Filipino Americans' contributions to the labor unions way back in the day, was even interesting for me to learn about, because I'm still relearning a lot about my culture, especially in terms of Filipinos in America, as opposed to just the Filipinos in the Philippines experience. So I think having those two even diasporas like right next to each other was really impactful to me and gave me a little bit more hope in the publishing industry in that way. So I highly recommend, if you're ever looking for a book that really talks about intergenerational traumas and interconnectivity in one's own family and even the relationship between a person, like just a person whose culture is feels far away but not really isn't really. So I really appreciated this book and what it really brought to, like, because it's a young adult novel to teens who maybe have relatives that have this experience or is just looking for something a little bit different, or even to adults who have, like, I never had this as growing up. I'm like, now's the time. Yeah. Now's the time to, like, experience that. Yep. And I think it's been really healing and refreshing to be able to have these type of representation now. So it's like not a better late than ever. It's kind of like a, yes, now I have this
as
a person. So.
Yeah.
Right. And I really, really hope the publishing, I mean, it's not perfect. It has ways to go. And I'm just really hoping, given everything else in the world, it doesn't pull back at all.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like it is.
Yeah.
Right now. But I mean, we can see a ways out. The things that are coming down the pike, and I feel like we're still
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I know. Crossing fingers, knocking on wood, and all of that stuff.
Yep.
All right. I think I've got the last book of the day, and this one surprised me when I first heard about it. It is The Magician of Tiger Castle by Louis Sacher. He is the Newbery and National Book Award winning author of Holes. Which came out in the 98, sorry.
Amazing book.
But the interesting thing about it, that's not what brought him to my attention. I read the Wayside books, which started coming out in the 70s, I guess. I was reading them in the early 80s as an early chapter book.
Yeah.
And I actually, I don't think I read Holes. I think I saw most of the movie, but I don't actually think I read Holes. But I'm aware of it, and I know the story. And so this is actually his first book geared towards adults. It is a rollicking fantasy. I almost can't top. There's some really lovely quotes on the back of this from people who grew up on him, like me. Alex Harrow, who's a New York Times bestselling author of The Snarling House, said, "After decades of children's stories with adult intelligence, Sacher has given us an adult novel with a child's heart." Since it really is. It is one of those things where you're sort of, you get, so A, you know from the beginning the story is being told by Anatole, who is a, you figure it out very, like, within the first 5 minutes, that he is telling this, his life story, or the pivotal moments of his life. But he is sitting in a cafe in modern times outside of the castle that he used to work at in the Renaissance. And you're kind of looking at this and thinking, how did that get happen? All the way through, you're wondering how this ends. How, you know, he survives, which is the positive. But you're also like, how did he get here? It is a story of true love. It is a story of a not terribly courageous magician having to figure out whether he has a backbone, how he can help people, what are the best moral decisions in a really awful situation. There's a princess who is betrothed as a child to an older prince. And at the time, she's fine, but of course, as the time grows near for the marriage, she, of course, does not want to get married to this person. She's fallen in love with this scribe in this kingdom. They've done nothing. It's fairly, nothing really has happened, but somebody tells that they're spending too much time together. And so the scribe is thrown in the dungeon, and the princess is going to be forced to marry. And of course, the incoming prince finds out about it, and he wants the scribe killed immediately as part of the wedding ceremony. It's all messy. He's horrible. He's horrible in so many ways. but Anatole, the princess is very dear to him. He wants to help the princess. He's really great at potions, which is key to the whole story, because he's not great at a lot of things, but he is really quite good at potions, given enough time. But it's trying to help the princess, becoming friends with the scribe in the dungeon, and then thinking, okay, now I've got to save the scribe. The prince is awful. Can I do something to the prince? It's just, and he's not a killer. He's just sort of trying to get things, move things in the right direction, and he doesn't really know what he's doing in a lot of ways, and it's fun, and it's harrowing, and it's, there are tigers. It's a lovely kind of whimsical fantasy cover, and it features tigers, potions, and rats, and that is very appropriate for the story. But it's a lot of fun, very quirky. It really reminds me of the Wayside Stories in that sense. So I think everybody should give it a try. It's a very lovely audiobook too. I listened to the majority of it.
Okay. Wow. So. That's great. It's a rollicking adventure.
It is a rollicking adventure. Yep.
Did it kind of feel like if the Wayside books were just adult, as someone who was a fan of them?
In some way, in the episodic way it presents, yes.
Okay.
Because it's like chapter to chapter, you're like, wait a minute, what? And then it kind of goes into the next chapter.
Was it in a positive way?
Sometimes. No, I really enjoyed the book, but sometimes it's like.
Yeah. I find that like authors that I grew up reading went from teen to adult, yes, clearly in their... But sometimes when I read the adult versions, adult books that they write, part of me is like...
This could have been a teen book.
I can see that you were a teen author.
Yes. And the thing is, that's so very... the overlap between what Maddie and I are buying right now is huge.
Yeah.
And the number of, I'll kind of look at her and say,
yeah,
okay, they're jumping. Okay, this is jumping too.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
I don't know if this is still the case, but when I was in library school, I remember hearing that YA was, or young adult teen books, was like one of the largest growing sections.
I don't feel like that's the case anymore. Yeah, I feel like it's that middle line of that they're jumping into often.
Right, like that's kind of an entry way. And even some authors out there, YA authors said, well, actually I wrote this as an adult book, but the publisher said it had to be YA.
Well, that's like, okay. Sarah Moss right there.
Yeah.
Which is why she's now in our adult section.
Exactly, right, right. So maybe once they prove themselves, that's they're true. Like.
I was, because I just, again, I mentioned that I was reading far above my grade level, which just meant I was reading far too advanced for my age. Which is like not an uncommon experience.
No.
So I've been a really huge advocate for just like new adult being like the new genre. Like I so desperately want that because I remember just being like 19, 20 and being like, I want to read, like young adult books is like what I want to read, but there's not like a space for me to read. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in like adult fantasy, which is the young adult books that I was reading. And then as I aged, I was like, well, I don't want to read teen books because young adult is for young adults. And I find sometimes that there are some genres and tropes that are utilized in adult books and I'm like, this is so derivative. I'm losing my mind. and I wish that like there was more awareness and a little bit more education on like new adult can be a genre. This could be like such a burgeoning.
It is, like, but it isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a genre. It is a real thing.
Yeah.
But it is.
It's like this weird middle thing that I think that people don't know how to market very well. So then
they're just marketing
the books badly on either way.
They're going more towards genre than they are the actual.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think is just really hard to promote or know how to talk about stuff. Because then, I don't know, the online spaces that I occupy when people recommend books, I just am like, I don't trust you because you put this here and I just don't agree with you or the way that they talk about genre. I'm like, I don't think you know what belongs in here. And like, maybe that's me being a little judgmental and pretentious. I'm willing to own up to that.
But,
there is.
I sure wish we would disagree more often in public.
Yeah. It's true.
That's yeah. funny.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, Maddie, you said it.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, it's also a librarian in those yeah. spaces too, you know, because yeah. you're so immersed in it in a yeah. different way.
Yeah, yeah. absolutely.
I right. feel like it's,
yeah. But I am like, I was talking to a friend recently about the quality of middle grade novels has just gone up as I've noticed yeah. and been like in charge of the collections at Downtown, South Lansing, and Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just so cool. There's like, they're well written. They're really thought out. There's mm-hmm. yeah. a little bit something for everyone, where I'm sure that that existed when I was a kid, but right. they just weren't super marketed very well.
Yeah.
And I mean, my I am just often set me loose in the library.
Yeah, impressed with just like, there's so many different ways to enter reading. Like, oh, I mean, absolutely. If you are a sports person, if you are yeah. a fantasy person, if you really like yeah. realistic fiction,
yeah.
if graphic novels is all you read, yeah. I mean, there are interesting stories everywhere
yeah.
in yes. middle grade. And again, I don't know that I found those when I was
yeah. right.
in eighth grade.
It didn't exist for us in yeah. the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, there were authors, but there was so much like gatekeeping and I yeah. mean, there just wasn't the diversity of authors. There yeah. wasn't the range. It just,
right.
it's
right.
exploded in such a good way.
Right.
It needs like to do more of them.
I'm saying all this without a microphone, but I feel like for me when I was younger, what I really craved and what I'm really diving into now as an adult is interesting nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Where like you read a textbook and that's just not the way right. that you retain
right.
information
yeah. right.
in any way. And so like the thought of reading a nonfiction book to me as a kid was like, absolutely not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But now like I'm starting to actually start to look into history and things mm-hmm. that were never interesting yeah. to me before because I'm like seeing it from a very specific perspective. Like yeah. I've talked about this with my partner a lot, who's an archivist, where like, having some context for historical yeah. events, like I like learning about historical movements through art and like
yeah. right.
the art of the time, and that made right. learning about history so much more fun for me. And I
yeah.
wish
yep.
that kids were kind of pushed more towards like, there are interesting ways to learn about history. We just don't have the resources to like explore that with kids and like educate them in that way. So
yeah.
mm-hmm.
I think that stuff is really important too.
That's why I've been really impressed with the I Survive books.
Oh, yeah.
I just, like, when I check them in or I'm processing them, I'm like, wow, what a really brutal time of the world. But I'm so happy kids are able to, like,
yeah.
enter into it and, like, be interested in mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, introduced to all sorts of, like, I never knew about that molasses thing. Or
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
just little snippets of history that I hope will stick with kids because there are so many different...
Yeah.
Different events, of course, that you might have a pass when you're in sixth grade, but you're not going to remember it
yeah.
necessarily. And these chapter books that, you know, I Survived, Girls Survive, I mean, they just really hone in on some little
yeah.
event in
yeah.
history that was really notable for those communities. So,
yeah. Yeah.
All right. All right. We've taken on publishing. We've taken on...
Figured it out.
Yep.
No,
you're going to bring up
probably
its
not.
Secrets.
All right, so go off, read freely, enjoy the fall weather as it's out there, and please come to our One Grand Read event.
Yes,
yeah. Check out Christian Cooper's Better Living Through Birding.
Yep, and there are lots of copies in Mel, just in case you're thinking, oh my gosh, there's so many holds. I hope that's still true today.
I just got my movie
checkout. All right.
It's moving, and I'll take a look at it and see if we need more, but it's moving. Okay. Cool. All right. Thank you, guys.